Listening to CJSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Extreme weather whiplash is coming as we warm the world. Malte Stucker found El Nino and La Nina get stronger and links up with other big ocean systems like the North Atlantic and Indian Oceans. The result is climate-driven weather whiplash from severe drought to extreme rain and floods year to year in a predictable seesaw of disasters. Next story, over 50,000 Europeans died due to excess heat in 2023 and 2024. Even wealthy countries can't adapt, and it's going to get worse. Dr. Christopher Callahan with latest findings on heat deaths in Europe. Finally, hourly temperatures reveal a week less winter and over a week more heat stress in parts of America, distinguished Professor Sandra Uter explains. Three breaking science interviews this week on Radio EcoShock. Let's go.
Thunder before the apocalypse, long future, calling in, calling out, consumer soldiers, merchants of waste, disappearing, green, watching storm makers, heat fakers, life takers, empty out everything.
What if extreme weather systems across all oceans start working together? We find that strange new future in a study in Nature Communications. The title is Global Climate Mode Resonance Due to Rapidly Intensifying El Niño Southern Oscillation. We reached the lead author, well-published climate meteorologist Malte Stucker. Malte heads or is part of several research institutes at the University of Hawaii. From Honolulu, Malte Stucker, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
It is hard to imagine these large systems going from the ocean to the atmosphere. Here on land, we just experience weather systems, extremes in some years and not others. How should we picture these mechanisms, Malte, as the atmospheric events, or are they changes in the ocean? What are they?
These very large climate patterns, you know, that El Nino and La Nina, for instance, are part of, are really characterized by changes in the ocean currents and global wind patterns that occur together. So it's really the ocean and the atmosphere changing together. So in contrast, when we refer to our daily weather, the geographical extent is much smaller and the typical duration of events is relatively short. So importantly, the large climate patterns shift how likely specific weather patterns that we experience on a daily basis are in a given year.
So let's talk about major weather makers. We pretty well know about El Nino and La Nina, known as ENSO. But even people living along the Atlantic seldom hear about the North Atlantic Oscillation, and that can mean harsh years or not. What is the North Atlantic Oscillation, and what does it do?
So the North Atlantic Oscillation, or NAO, as we sometimes call it in short, describes the atmospheric circulation over the North Atlantic, especially in Northern Hemisphere winter, which has important impacts on weather in Europe. So it is measuring the difference in sea level pressure between the Azores Islands and Iceland. A positive North Atlantic oscillation means that the jet stream is very strong in that year and a northward shift of the storm track, leading to more stormy and relatively warm and wet winters in Northern Europe and less stormy and therefore drier winters in Southern Europe. So in contrast, a negative North Atlantic oscillation means a wavier, meandering jet stream leading to the opposite weather patterns. We have increased storminess with warm and wet conditions in Southern Europe, whereas Northern Europe is much colder and drier typically.
And then for listeners in Australia and East Asia, we have a third system called the Indian Ocean Dipole. Could you introduce us to that?
Sure. The Indian Ocean Dipole is, in a way, El Nino's small cousin in the Indian Ocean. So similar to El Nino, it is characterized by changes in tropical sea surface temperatures, but these are occurring in the Indian Ocean instead of the Pacific Ocean. And these, in turn, affect weather patterns in countries surrounding the Indian Ocean. A positive Indian Ocean Dipole means that sea surface temperatures in around Indonesia are typically colder than usual, leading to less rainfall in Australia, whereas in contrast, a negative Indian Ocean Dipole means that the ocean surface temperatures are much warmer than usual in Indonesia, leading to more rainfall in Australia.
So what did you and your colleagues set out to do in this new study?
So we were analyzing a set of new climate model simulations that have a much higher resolution than most previous climate models, which leads to a better representation of a number of atmospheric and oceanic phenomena, including a more realistic representation of El Niño in that model. So during that analysis, we found that El Niño undergoes a kind of tipping into a very different regime. So in the current climate, El Niño and La Niña events occur relatively irregular and are of moderate strength. We only have extreme El Niño events maybe once a decade or so. But in the model, we see the switch to this very different regime that oscillates very regular between strong El Niño and strong La Niña years in response to greenhouse warming.
So is that why your paper used the most extreme IPCC pathway called SSP5 to 8.5?
This was actually the first simulation that we had ready to analyze. We are actually now looking at other emission scenarios as well in this new model. And there's an indication that El Niño undergoes this tipping point in these experiments as well. But this is still very much ongoing research, and we hope to say something more definite on this very soon.
Do we know what regulates ocean-to-atmosphere patterns, the kinds we've been talking about? Why is 1 year El Niño and then we get three La Niña years?
Two scientists, one meteorologist, Jacob Bjerknes, and then one oceanographer, Klaus Wirtke, really laid the foundation for understanding of these climate patterns in the late 1960s to early 80s. So the key is that there's a positive feedback between the tropical Pacific Ocean and the atmospheric circulation, very similar to a loop where an acoustic signal from a loudspeaker gets feedback into a microphone and amplifies. An anomalously warm Pacific Ocean, so-called El Niño, causes the trade winds to weaken, which in turn reduces this upwelling of cooler waters in the eastern Pacific, which in turn leads to the surface ocean to warm even further. So that's what we call this positive feedback. But at the same time, this weakening of the trade winds leads to a change in the ocean currents that transport water in the subsurface ocean up to several hundred meters deep between the tropics and subtropics. So during an El Niño, warm water in the subsurface Pacific Ocean is transported away from the equator, thereby cooling the subsurface ocean and eventually leading to a La Niña event. And it is this transport of warm water away from the equator, this can be very strong, and it can take then several years for it to flow back to the equator. So that's the reason why we often have these multi-year La Niña conditions. And maybe the best way to think of it is as a similar to a recharging and discharging of a battery. So if we have all this excess warm water in the equatorial subsurface ocean, we have the conditions that are set for an El Niño event. However, once an El Niño occurs, the battery discharges, so water flows away from the equator in the subsurface ocean, which then leads to a La Niña. And then it takes several years to recharge this battery again to allow for El Niño conditions to occur again.
What is hydroclimate whiplash?
So this is a term that has been more frequently used in recent years, and it refers to extreme swings between climate conditions. So, for instance, we typically see drought in Australia during El Niño and more rainfall during La Niña. Now, if we have very regular swings between El Niño and La Niña, we would see a constant whiplash between very dry and very wet weather without many years of normal conditions in between. So this is what we call hydroclimate whiplash.
For over 15 years, you published peer-reviewed papers investigating large-scale atmospheric cycles, the kind we've been talking about. Tell us about the resonance developing in global climate modes.
So El Niño is the biggest player, really, in the climate system. As we discussed, the swings between El Niño and La Niña affect weather patterns globally. But there are many other climate patterns that occur as well, such as the aforementioned Indian Ocean Dipole, or the North Atlantic Oscillation. In the current climate, we see some influence of El Niño on these other climate patterns. For instance, the Indian Ocean Dipole occurs quite frequently during El Niño events, while for the North Atlantic Oscillation, this connection with El Niño is currently very weak. But not all Indian Ocean Dipole events in the current climate are caused by El Niño. They occur frequently also independently of what's happening in the Pacific Ocean with El Niño or La Niña. So in our experiments, we see that as El Niño and La Niña become more regular and much stronger as the planet warms due to our greenhouse gas emissions, the impact of El Niño and La Niña on all these other climate phenomena increases significantly. So we can think of these different climate phenomena. In this case, this would be El Niño, the Indian Ocean Dipole, the North Atlantic Oscillation, among others, as different metronomes that are connected to each other by sitting on a wooden plank that can transmit the vibrations between the different metronomes. Now, El Niño has its intrinsic period, which is like a 3 to 7 year oscillation in the current climate. So as different metronomes can synchronize to a common oscillation frequency when they are coupled together, the other climate phenomena can synchronize with El Niño in our model simulations. So what ends up happening is that all the other climate phenomena follow the large and regular swings between El Niño and La Niña, and this is what we call resonance.
European forecasters do not see La Niña or El Niño as primary drivers of weather in Europe. Could that change, and how can we understand the interlocking of systems, how it's going to apply to Europe, for example?
Correct. So while El Niño in the current climate has very strong impacts on countries surrounding the Pacific and Indian Oceans, it does not affect weather over Europe very much. However, in our experiments show that the aforementioned North Atlantic Oscillation synchronizes with El Niño in this warmer climate. That is, it really swings back and forth following the swings of El Niño and La Niña. Thereby, El Niño is then affecting temperatures and rainfall over Europe.
If the model is correct, by 2050 or so, Earth would enter a dangerous new phase of weather patterns that are no longer irregular but more predictable. Tell us about the model your team used, and briefly, how did you cross-check results?
We are using a relatively new climate model, which is among the best performing ones. We also checked all the previous models that were used during the last IPCC assessment, and found that there are a few models that show a similar behavior. However, we cannot yet provide an estimate on how likely this emergence of global resonance really is. So we are really actively working now on the question by examining what the models that show this behavior have in common and what distinguishes them from the models that don't show this behavior.
Could there be advantages to more predictability so governments and people can plan or adapt?
This increased regularity of El Niño, together with the emergence of global resonance between the different climate phenomena, indeed implies higher predictability of regional weather patterns. So the critical question, however, will be if a given region or country will be able to adapt to those regular and frequent swings between local weather extremes, you know, such as the year-to-year swings between droughts and higher than normal rainfall in Australia.
The strongest and most damaging El Niño events were in 1982-83, again in 97 and 98, and most recently in 2015-2016. I would add the weaker El Niño in 2023 because it pushed a record heat that year and following. As we go ahead to 2050, does your model suggest even these past monsters will seem tame compared to much stronger and more damaging El Niños coming regularly?
Yes. It is a rather robust result that as the Earth warms, the hydrological cycle intensifies. And El Niño of the same magnitude as those that you mentioned in 82, 83, 97, 98, and 15, 16 will already cause much more extreme weather swings in a warmer climate. An even stronger El Niño event will further amplify these weather swings.
A theme in your long work is the search for predictability for coming seasons. Why is that important to you and to all of us?
So accurately predicting regional rainfall and temperature for upcoming seasons is critically important for all sectors of society. For instance, it affects decision-making in the agricultural sector, water resource management, and disaster preparedness in general.
So we picture the ocean 30 years from now. It may be hotter all over. Is it possible general ocean warming will overwhelm the El Niño event? For example, a new study finds pan basin warming now overshadows robust Pacific decadal oscillation. How do you see the relationship between continuing heating and current drivers like El Niño?
The general ocean warming and El Niño events will compound each other. So the natural temperature and rainfall swings associated with an El Nino will occur on top of a much warmer baseline climate, which will then intensify the impacts of El Nino.
A paper 20 years ago by your colleague Axel Timmermann suggested the ENSO cycle reaches, quote, a crossing of a Hopf bifurcation in the mid-21st century. In the new paper, you also found the noise of random weather leans towards a more predictable pattern, possibly around mid-century. Can we think of this bifurcation as a kind of tipping point in large atmospheric systems?
Yes, a Hopf bifurcation is indeed a tipping point at which a system transitions to a very regular oscillation, which is exactly what we find occurring with El Nino in our experiments. So in the current climate, El Nino is highly irregular, occurring maybe every 3 to 7 years. But after this Hopf bifurcation tipping point, it becomes a regular oscillation, always swinging back and forth between El Nino and La Nina without remaining much in so-called normal conditions, exactly as the aforementioned metronome example.
Is it fair to say a top-level model suggests continuing warming might create a new rhythm in global weather, predictable months ahead or even maybe years ahead?
Yes, that's indeed what our studies so far suggest.
And does your work say that in coming decades we might experience weather more extreme than anything seen so far, or just extremes more often?
So our study suggests that likely both will be the case.
That's not great news. Okay, so once large oceanic systems like ENSO, the North Atlantic Oscillation, the Indian Dipole become coupled, would you suggest this is a permanent change, like a new weather future for Earth?
Yes, this is indeed what our experiments project. However, it is important to emphasize that we as humans will determine what our emissions are going to be, and with that how much warming and changes in the climate system we will experience. So we are certainly not locked into this possible future.
Suppose this state-of-the-art coupled climate model developed by the Alfred Wegener Institute is correct. What are we risking with continuing emissions if that new weather future turns out to be true?
The capability to adapt to these highly regular weather swings induced by El Nino will differ vastly from region to region, from country to country, and from sector to sector. Certainly exploring potential adaptation pathways is critical for regions that already see strong El Nino or La Nina impacts in the current climate. But pursuing adaptation in regions that so far were largely spared from El Nino's impacts, such as Europe, could potentially be more difficult.
Are you looking for a general theory of weather relativity, so to speak? And what are you working on now?
A lot of research has shown that further improving our understanding of El Nino and its role in the global climate system is key to both improving seasonal climate predictions that we discussed, as well as narrowing down remaining uncertainties in regional climate change projections, such as extreme weather events as the Earth continues to warm. So I would say the overarching goal of my research, as well as the International Pacific Research Center, which I am the director of, is to provide people with the most robust information on climate and weather hazards, and thereby informing both mitigation and adaptation efforts, be it preparing for the next season or the next decades.
From the University of Hawaii at Manoa, we have been speaking with Dr. Malte Stucker. He leads the new paper, Global Climate Mode Resonance Due to Rapidly Intensifying El Nino Southern Oscillation. Find links and more discussion in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Malte, thank you for helping us with this big picture.
Thank you for your time.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
This is a climate emergency. Find out more on the blog. EcoShock.org. No sign up, just the latest info, free for all. EcoShock.org.
Europe is warming faster than anywhere else on the planet other than the Arctic. In 2003, a deadly heat wave killed tens of thousands of Europeans. A study by the Barcelona Institute for Global Health found over 60,000 heat-related deaths last year in the summer of 2024. What will it be like when the whole Earth is significantly hotter due to climate change? A new paper in Nature Climate Change investigates increasing risk of mass human heat mortality in Europe. The lead author is Dr. Christopher Callahan from Indiana University and the Dorr School of Sustainability at Stanford. Christopher Callahan, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us about the deadly heat wave in Europe and why it is a focus for climate-driven deaths, that one in 2003.
Yeah, Europe is uniquely vulnerable to the health impacts of extreme heat. It's a place where air conditioning is relatively minimal, at least compared to the United States, and it's a place where the hottest temperatures of the year are rising very rapidly, creating the potential for very deadly conditions. It's also a place where we have already seen very severe heat waves. In August of 2003, there was a very devastating heat wave across France and many other countries in Western Europe, which was really in some ways the first catastrophic heat wave of the climate change era. But now we are seeing similar conditions recur as global temperatures rise, making each additional heat wave more and more dangerous since we're trapping heat in the atmosphere with greenhouse gases.
Well, weather, including heat waves, is notoriously variable. It always has been. How did your group isolate what deaths were caused by weather versus climate change?
Absolutely. We used a machine learning algorithm that had been previously developed by some of our collaborators at Stanford that was able to predict extreme heat conditions in a way that incorporated both the impact of climate change in terms of warming temperatures, as well as the other sort of random variable weather conditions, like how dry the soil is, how intense the heat dome overhead is, and so on. And so we were able to make predictions about future heat waves that said, let's control for all those natural factors. Let's assume the weather variability stays the same, but that in the background, there is this steady march of rising global temperatures. And when you put those two together is when you get really dangerous conditions.
Well, as climate protection seemed to be failing, I mean, emissions are increasing. More scientists warn 3 degrees C of global warming is possible this century. We might pass 2 degrees of warming in a decade or two. What happens, Chris, when a 2003-level heat storm hits Europe again, but in a 3-degree hotter world?
We found that as many as 30,000 people could die across Europe in a single week if the weather conditions that happened in August of 2003 happen again, but the Earth is 3 degrees Celsius warmer than it was in pre-industrial conditions because of human greenhouse gases. This is obviously a staggering death toll. It's close to some of the worst weeks of the COVID pandemic, meaning that it would be associated with significant pressures on the health system and other significant social instabilities.
Okay, but people with means do adapt. A new paper from Christopher Callahan and colleagues found, quote, recent adaptation to heat in France has reduced the projected death tolls of future 2003-like events by more than 75%, end quote. How did you and your 6 co-authors handle expected reduction in deaths as humans adjust and take protective measures?
There's a couple of different things going on here. One is that after the 2003 event, we do see that France is sort of a success story for adaptation to heat. So, for example, they required all nursing homes to have at least one air-conditioned room, which is really important for safeguarding the health of elderly people who are particularly vulnerable. On the other hand, we have not seen comprehensive adaptation to extreme heat spread across Europe in a really universal way. In the more recent paper we published, we showed that if you take existing patterns of adaptation across space and project them into the future to assume that people adapt at the same pace they are now, we would reduce the future death toll of these events by about 10%. That doesn't mean that adaptation is useless, because it could be accelerated. It's just that we have to make the choice to accelerate it rather than simply assuming that it will occur on its own.
So you think future heat waves will overwhelm adaptation even in wealthy countries in Europe?
I think it depends on the policy choices made by those countries. If countries make significant investments in expanding air conditioning, creating heat action plans, creating public cooling centers, doing outreach to vulnerable and isolated people, these are all techniques that we know can reduce the death toll of heat events. But they are choices that have to be made by policymakers. And right now we're seeing major fights even in domestic politics in some European countries, about how heavily to invest in air conditioning. So ultimately, it's not a foregone conclusion that these countries will be able to successfully adapt.
Plus, then we have a minor problem that heat waves also stress power plants, and so the grid can go down and the AC doesn't work. And there you have people who have expectations that they're safe, and suddenly they're not.
That's absolutely correct. A really dangerous situation for an extreme heat event would be the reduction in electricity availability or overall blackouts as the grid is stressed. Luckily, one of the same investments, renewable energy, that reduces carbon emissions, also creates resilience to extreme heat events. Solar panels are extremely effective when it's hot out and the sun is shining, much more so than thermal power plants like gas or coal, which require cooling from water and from nearby rivers, which we've seen be vulnerable in previous heat waves. So we have the opportunity to mitigate some of these risks, but it's a choice that we have to make.
Currently in Europe, extreme cold is supposed to cause 8 to 10 times more deaths than extreme heat. But how do you see that balance? Is it changing? Now heat's the big threat and not cold?
One of the things that researchers, including myself and my collaborators right now, are still trying to figure out is what is the relative danger of extreme cold versus extreme heat conditions. It does appear that overall, cold conditions are responsible for more deaths than hot conditions, and this is mostly because in places like the United States and Europe, we experience a lot of very cold conditions in much of the winters that we have. That said, we know that climate change is causing increases in temperature year-round, and so in the future, we can certainly expect more and more heat-related deaths, irrespective of how many deaths are also caused by cold.
So there is another outlier, and it's being talked about more and more. If the Atlantic meridional overturning circulation weakens or fails, then the warm tropical waters stop coming to the UK and northern Europe. Surely that would greatly change any projections and maybe bring back cold rather than heat again.
Yeah, changes in the Atlantic circulation are a significant uncertainty in what the future climate holds, especially for Europe. I'm not an expert in that circulation, so I'm not going to speculate about details, but I can say that if that circulation were to slow down or fail entirely, there would be significant alterations to many different weather patterns in Europe.
One other minor factor on this program, Dr. Camilo Mora from the University of Hawaii told us extreme heat causes organ damage that can show up in deaths up to a year or more later. So there may be a long tail to extreme heat waves and deaths. Did your study take delayed deaths into account?
We only looked at deaths during the week of the heat and the several weeks after. So if it is possible that heat causes damage or injury that might recur, you know, months or years later, that would only raise the total death toll that we anticipate, but it wasn't directly considered in our study.
Also on Radio EcoShock, Greek scientist Matt Santamouros said the threshold temperature for excess mortality differs. For example, in his native Athens, the danger line is close to 32.5 degrees C, 90 Fahrenheit. People there are adapted to high temperatures, but in London, it's much, much lower when people start to show up in emergency wards. Did your study account for this, and are expectations for mass heat deaths different in southern and northern Europe?
Yes, that's absolutely correct. Our study did account for this, where we were able to assess how different locations are vulnerable to different levels of temperature, depending on how adapted they have been historically. So we do see that in colder places, like in northern Europe, it takes less of a heat wave to cause the same death as in southern Europe, because places in northern Europe are less well adapted to those extreme conditions. That said, exactly where the most extreme death toll would occur depends on the location of the heat itself, which sort of depends upon the weather variability. But what we can say is that in general, the same heat wave with the same temperature will end up being more dangerous to people who are living in relatively cold places than people who are living in relatively warm places.
That's so counterintuitive, but it's good to know.
Yeah, absolutely. In the United States, for example, if you think about a heat wave hitting Seattle versus Houston, places in Houston or Texas have a lot more air conditioning than places that typically don't need it.
Well, yes. In the 2021 heat dome here in the Vancouver area in British Columbia, we lost 600 people because there's no air conditioning and no prior experience of that kind of heat.
Absolutely. That 2021 event in particular was one of the most extreme